Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's home edition, recorded on this date, November 17th, 2020. Well, Saturday, the uneasy truce between Morocco and the Sahrawi people of Western Sahara cracked. The New York Times reports the Western Sahara pro-independence organization Polisario Front has declared war, breaking a 30-year-old UN-brokered ceasefire agreement between Morocco and the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic. Dr. Jeffrey Smith is a Canadian law academic and lawyer who's written extensively on Western Sahara human rights and environmental protections under international law. He served as legal advisor to the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic for more than a decade. Jeffrey Smith in the first half. And 2 weeks ago, the federal government in Ethiopia launched military attacks against the rest of northern province of Tigray. Today, thousands are fleeing the fighting of the internal conflict outside observers say could become the Libya of East Africa. Selamawi Gebremeskel is an Ethiopian emigre living in Canada for nearly 30 years. Salam is a healthcare professional and UVic grad calling Victoria home. Salam Gebremeskel and Mogis Kebedi anxiously watching developments in Ethiopia in the second half. And Victoria, broadcaster and host of CFUV's Planet Powered Radio, Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bulletin of some of the good things to be gotten up to in and around our town and virtually too in the coming week. But first, Jeffrey Smith and breaking a bad peace in Western Sahara. Welcome to the program, Jeffrey. I'm sure most of our listeners are unaware of the plight of the Sahrawi people or the existence of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic. Who, Jeffrey, and what is the SADR?
Well, it's a great question, Chris, a fine one to start with. In kind of formal or narrow terms, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, SADR, is a nation state in Northwest Africa. It exists and functions in some very unusual circumstances, as any other state would. Now, the other and fuller part of that answer is that is the government and democratically elected institutions operating a country or a country in exile that are kind of the reverse side or the mirror image of the Sahrawi People's Liberation Movement dating 1970s, the Polisario Front, which is the popular front for the liberation of, well, Western Sahara. Polisario is the former Spanish names for the territory now known as Western Sahara. And I say this because the two are intertwined. You have on the one side a national liberation movement that is the representative organization for self-determination in United Nations circles. You have on the other side an elected democratic government functioning with state institutions in an African Union setting. So that distinction and the duality are important.
The Polisario Front has declared war. Are they speaking for everyone in this, or is there unity between the Polisario Front and the SADR?
There would be a unity, as between the two institutions or their leadership or the decision-making circles. But your question, of course, is one of representation. Is this an act? Is this a decision that is made with democratic or representative legitimacy? Because it's emanating from an elected government, the answer is yes. It may be controversial, it's a government decision, although expressed generally throughout the media as coming from the Polisario Front.
You mentioned that it's not exactly a state as we might recognize it. Can you describe that? And I'm interested to know, how do they get the bottle to declare war on Morocco, which is a much larger entity?
It's a remarkable turn of events these last several days. The Sahrawi Republic, the governing institutions as a whole, be they Polisario Front or indeed more local government organizations, sort of subnational entities, should be best viewed as a government and a state in exile of course, there's a territorial control over the inland part, about 20% of the territory of Western Sahara, and a sort of minimal population presence. But really, this is a state which is finds a significant part of its population, although a part of it under occupation in Western Sahara proper, finds a significant part of its population in refugee camps just inside southwest Algeria. So that constrains what things would do. The other thing on a geopolitical global level is that the Sahrawi Republic is not universally recognized. It's not it's recognized widely and heavily throughout Africa. It has African Union membership. It is otherwise recognized extensively, but not completely, throughout the global south. It's not recognized at all in global north, or what we used to think of as first world countries. So that creates diplomatic, legal, and other problems, including the resolution of the question of occupation, the resolution of self-determination within Western Sahara. The other part of your question is perhaps about capacity to undertake armed conflict. Less perhaps a declaration of war than a recognition, understanding that hostilities are, if in a very limited way, resuming, that they have, that what was a ceasefire in effect under a UN brokered agreement toward a self-determination referendum in September 1991 has broken down, or, and I use the word, it's recognized as a return to hostilities, because the terms of the ceasefire have been violated in the far south of the occupied part of Western Sahara. So that's a slight nuance. It's not a sort of declaration of war or of a return to war as much as it is an understanding or an assertion that a ceasefire which has held has itself been undermined or violated.
If the Western Sahrawi are not recognized in the global north necessarily, at least their sovereignty over the contested area. The UN, as you mentioned, they have recognized the people, and they recognize that there should be a referendum. Morocco is the de facto ruler of the region right now. I'd like to know, first of all, what claim or right of claim Morocco has in the first place, why they think they can run the show and take out the resources, and what and how the referendum has progressed since 1991.
You know, again, more great questions. The answer is that there is no answer to a claim of territory made by Morocco. Uniquely, in a decolonizing world after 1945, in the era of the UN Charter and accelerating through the 1960s to really today's incomplete cases or projects, the territory of Western Sahara and its people had the benefit of a legal decision, an advisory opinion on decolonization from the International Court of Justice in October 1975, a few weeks before the territory was invaded. And that decision disposed of, it eliminates a territorial claim. Even if there had been some basis or a foundation, some historical connection to claim part or all of Western Sahara, that was further overcome in the court recognizing or underscoring, really emphasizing, the right of the Sahrawi people as colonized people under the colonial yoke of Spain to exercise self-determination, which included then and still includes a right to choose independence if they wish. You won't, it's an interesting sort of media studies thing. As you observe the history and the current conflict in Western Sahara, you won't find much recourse or reminder of the 1975 judgment, the 1975 ICJ opinion. It provides a complete answer. There is no territorial claim. And the Sahrawi people have, as with the people of East Timor, say, or Namibia, an entire right to choose options of their political future.
Well, the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, and if they don't recognize Morocco, what's behind the reluctance of the United Nations or the European Union and the global north generally to recognize the Sahrawi's people's claim on this land and its resources?
It's a reluctance of all the rest of us, our governments, our countries, and at a certain level ourselves as individuals. International law applies to us. To positively act to realize the right of self-determination. The cover for that, the convenience that we're offered, is a deferral to the role of the United Nations, and in particular, the preeminent place of the UN Security Council, which has operational direction, no longer much the UN General Assembly, as in the great era of decolonization. It's the UN Security Council which has operational direction, including the UN's commitment in 1991 to itself administer a process of self-determination, in other words, a referendum. So the rest of the global community, faced with an inconvenient matter that has implications for diplomacy with Morocco and otherwise in Africa, simply takes an easy pass and defers to the Security Council, which in turn is reluctant in large measure because of the permanent five members' politics over the matter, the horse trading of Western Sahara, to proceed with the matter, to insist upon a durable outcome, to conform to both, again, the UN's commitments and an essential requirement of international law.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Jeffrey Smith. Dr. Smith is a Canadian law academic and lawyer. He's written extensively on Western Sahara human rights and environmental protections under international law. He's too served as legal advisor to the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic for more than a decade, among other human rights work he's engaged in. Well, I mentioned earlier that there's resources and that they, I think, along with wanting more territory, I suppose the Kingdom of Morocco is interested in benefiting and profiting from the resources offered. What are we talking about here? What are the riches and booty at hand for Morocco?
The two leading ones, acknowledging there's been prospecting for petroleum both on land and in the offshore in about the last 15, 18 years, the leading resources are phosphate mineral rock, chemical symbol P, that's phosphorus, very high grade, easily extracted, the commodity is. It's itself fascinating, only developed by Spain in the late 1960s and in production in the early 1970s, for which the significant part of exports were to Canada over the period 2011 through early 2019. As an interesting historical footnote, I can explain more if you wish why that's changed or ended. It's phosphorus rock for fertilizer, and what is Africa's richest fishery, most productive coastal fishery, immediately offshore that the European Union, in particular, has a treaty relationship with Morocco for, and had largely been a basis for Spain's colonial interest in acquisition of the Sahara, given the proximity of the Canary Islands. I should go on a bit further and say that the resources don't, because of the cost of the occupation, in particular a substantial military presence, and that along the so-called berm or sand wall that divides Morocco, that partitions Morocco, the cost of resources is somewhat less than the annual basic military occupation cost. So we might say, if it hasn't been profitable, why hold it? And the reasons are historical. They date back to the 1970s, and the project, Morocco's project, to acquire Western Sahara, to invade, as an exercise in acquiring territory largely. The prestige and the stability of the Moroccan government and monarchy was in question back in the era, in that era, and with Spain's rather sudden departure in 1975, the stage was set. To reverse that now would be, in domestic terms, very difficult. It arguably, I think the consensus would be that arguably threatens the stability of the Moroccan regime, that a loss of the Sahara has significant domestic implications in the country.
So they would lose face, but not necessarily lose a lot financially. I know there's a lot of resistance in Europe. They've got these fishing deals that you mentioned, but the people, there are campaigns in various countries, especially in the north of Europe, putting pressure on their governments. They've stopped phosphate imports, as has Canada too, and in the United States as well, as I understand it, phosphate being immensely important to agriculture. Why do you think that the European Union doesn't put more pressure on Morocco to cede control of this area? I mean, what leverage does Morocco have over Europe in this?
Considerable. Partly through immigration, including irregular migration of Moroccan nationals in Europe, and partly through the European Union's desire to maintain a fishing presence, the availability of a fishery for European Union commercial fishers off the coast of Western Sahara, and partly because of a desire to engage for trade and bilateral relationships, Morocco as a whole, within the context of the EU's European Mediterranean engagement strategy. There's deeper linkages and implications for that relationship. And we can see this to a degree, or compare this to a degree, by Spain's passive approach. International law is clear that Spain remains the colonial power or administering power, at least in theory, for Western Sahara. It could never transfer away that responsibility, but you won't find Spain diplomatically active on much aspects of the question of Western Sahara, because it has too many issues at stake otherwise in its particular relationship with Morocco. And that example, in a narrow way, helps us to understand the European Union position.
Well, we're being pretty abstract here. You're familiar with the way the people themselves actually live. Can you describe what it's like? I mean, for these people that are living without a country, where they live and what prospects they have given the current situation, should the status quo continue?
There are refugee people, in effect. The Sahrawi who would be part of an identifiable social, obviously political, and linguistic group. They number about, let's say, 300,000 to 400,000. 100,000 plus live within Western Sahara under occupation. There's historical reasons for that, substantially because they were unable to flee in 1975-76. The balance, more or less, almost 200,000 live in the refugee camps, six camps around the city of Tindouf in southwest Algeria. In a way, they're classic refugees. They could entirely move on and become a wider diaspora. There wouldn't be much political or certainly legal difficulty in absorbing them into Algerian society, but they don't want that. They maintain a homogeneous political, legal, cultural existence on the anticipation of a return of their territory to them through exercising self-determination. This has been a black letter, a formal UN commitment since 1991. So they would see that they would reduce that or erode that by becoming refugees in a classic sense and moving on, that a political impetus to get what law and the international community through the UN has promised would be yet further eroded. It's a remarkable thing. It's a maintaining of a refugee state in exile toward a political project of independence, as they would have it.
And as you mentioned, the United Nations has been kicking the ball down the field since 1991. Just last year, their representative was ill and left the file, and it's not been picked up since. I can understand that people are feeling abandoned. Is it fair to say that the UN has largely abandoned these people, or were they always abandoned? Did they never really have an interest?
Well, there was an interest through the 1990s through an extensive voter registration process and a number of efforts. Really through 2004, there had been an extensive work done toward the ideal of providing the right of self-determination, which again, exercising that is a vote, it's a plebiscite, it's a referendum, in parallel to the successful case of East Timor from 1999, really, through independence. But we might now say abandonment. And again, on the narrow point that it is a UN commitment to oversee a self-determination referendum, not some lesser process, not a compromise, not a partition. That requirement, and it's founded on probably the most solid rule or norm of international law or of human rights in international law, that fundamental of self-determination was always there. So two decades on from where that process ran into the sand, can we use the word abandoned? We're close to it, that's for sure.
Well, it's clear that they feel that way if they're taking up arms or threatening to do the same right now. Hannah Armstrong, writing for the American Scholar in June, she says that the Moroccans typically characterize the Sahrawi people as being primitive, unorganized, and even as a nursery for terrorists. But the journalist Armstrong says she goes there and she says, well, it's not like that at all. They've abolished the caste system. They've abolished tribal and ethnic distinctions within their society. She says what she finds is a grassroots, democratic, egalitarian government, matriarchal, women led primarily. And she says, quote, when she went there, I found a thriving constitutional democracy with committees composed mainly of women, fanatic in their dedication to education and healthcare, not a people that are just ready to be an addendum to some other country like Algeria or even Morocco.
I would agree with that. That has been my view, including when I am in the Tindouf camps. It's a remarkable society in exile, profoundly self-governing, relatively sophisticated across the institution, across social, societal, and governing institutions. Much more so, maybe this is the benefit of history, than similarly situated peoples in the great era of decolonization. Even Timor and Namibia, undeniably colonial occupied territories where with people having the right to self-determination, were nowhere as close to providing for themselves, organizing themselves, or eventually making a go of it. When they choose a political state-like structure, whatever that would be.
Well, Jeffrey, we're going to have to break here. Can you recommend some sources that our listeners can access to learn more about this region and this conflict in the making?
Yeah, there's lots online that's very credible. Google Western Sahara and then simply exercise your judgment or credibility, your credulity about what's put before you. There's some fun propaganda out there, I think probably on both sides. Certainly the website of Western Sahara Resource Watch, WSRW.org, is a really good one, especially for this Canadian connection now just passed. The International Crisis Group, ICG, has some dated papers that are pretty balanced. Human Rights Watch has some fascinating, although it's troubling, work on human rights in the occupied territory. The Robert F. Kennedy Center for Peace and Justice, I think now called RFK Center in the United States, has some interesting reports as well. There's lots out there that kind of gets beyond the obscurity of Western Sahara.
Dr. Jeffrey Smith, thanks a lot for coming on the show and sharing your expertise.
Chris, a real pleasure. You know, I'm happy at any time. And you know, thank you for your journalistic coverage of things.
Dr. Jeffrey Smith and I will continue this talk, and you can find the full discussion at guerrilla-radio.com. But for the rest of you, stay tuned, because Janine's going to be straight up with this week's edition of the Left Coast Events Bulletin.
Compassion Arts Festival that started on November 15th. It's running all the way till November 25th. Virtual festival lineup featuring a sampling of programs and projects that inspire the heart and move the soul. Categories like visual arts and exhibits, music, readings, performing arts, speakers, interviews, animals and nature, workshops, films, books, inspirations, and artists for Ahimsa Award and Love in Action and Holistic Nonviolence. So online, compassionarts.org is the website. On Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m., Canada's Role in Colombia's Humanitarian Tragedy, a Zoom webinar about Colombia's unfolding humanitarian tragedy and Trudeau government's role in it. Changes in foreign policy that have made our position on Colombia virtually indistinguishable from that of Trump's in the U.S. So that's tonight, Thursday, CLAA.ca for information there. Let's Do It Again, or Why We Need a World War II Style Mobilization to Fight Global Warming. Friday, November 20th, starting at 7, Rolling Justice Bus at Shaw.ca for more information and the Zoom link. Speakers include Seth Klein, Elizabeth May, and Anjali Appadurai, three prominent Canadian activists who will offer their perspectives on the climate crisis and the role we can play to mitigate its impacts and create a bold new vision based on justice and right relationship with our Earth. Friday, 7 till 8:30, November 20th. November 21st, Nation Rising Speaker Series presents David Simon, author of Meatonomics, and he'll be talking about the rigged economics of meat and dairy. So find out why, if you factor in animal cruelty, environmental damage, and healthcare costs, a fast food burger should cost triple the price. It's a Zoom presentation, and it's also on Facebook Live. On the 21st, a celebration for the turkeys. The Farm Sanctuary has been around for 35 years already, and they've always given turkeys a seat at the table, not on it. And this year, they're going virtual, so you can actually be there with them. Board President Emily Deschanel, President and Co-Founder Jean Bauer, and some plant-based chefs will be on hand, and some rescued turkeys. It's a free event, Saturday, November 21st, online. RAP Summit, Evolving Beyond Animal Agriculture. Want to end world hunger, pandemics, climate change, habitat destruction, wildlife extinction, and preventable diseases? We can do it by evolving beyond animal agriculture. So a lot of farmers and ranchers apparently during the pandemic expressing their interest in getting out of animal farming and into some other kind of farming. So this is a chance to hear from people who've done just exactly that. Renee King from Rowdy Girl Sanctuary will be on hand. Also, all kinds of other people's What the Health's Kip Anderson, Jane Unchained News, Jane Velez-Mitchell will be there. It's a free event, Saturday, November 21st from 10 till 12:30. On the 22nd, PolyCon 2020, honoring intersectionality and diversity in our communities, presenters and performers from all over the world. Online. On Wednesday, the 25th, Royal BC Museum presents Outside Indigenous Perspectives in Coastal for us with a cultural programmer from the Kwakwaka'wakw First Nation as we explore the forest of Mill Hill Regional Park from an Indigenous perspective. That could be fun. A webinar on Wednesday the 25th. Also on the 25th, Stop the Site C Dam, Why We Need to and How We Can. And lots of speakers, including Ken Boone, who's been on Guerrilla Radio many times, and an agrologist, and grassroots people, and a representative from Climate Convergence Metro Vancouver. So good speakers, Wednesday, November 25th, 7 p.m. And that's what I found for this week. Thanks, Chris.
The federal government in Ethiopia launched military attacks against the rest of northern province of Tigray. Today, thousands are fleeing the fighting of the internal conflict. Outside observers say could become the Libya of East Africa. Salamuit Gebremichael is an Ethiopian emigre living in Canada for nearly 30 years. Salam is a healthcare professional and UVic grad calling Victoria home now. Salam, tell me, what's going on in your hometown? Who are you talking to right now and what's going on there?
I have no way of talking to my family. My family are stranded in the war zone as soon as the war started. There is no phone call. There's no internet. The only news I'm hearing is news from the government of Ethiopia stating they're bombing. There's a war in land and an airstrike over the cities. So that's the only news that we're hearing. We don't know if our families are dead. We don't know if our families are alive. We don't know if our families are the ones that are fleeing to Sudan. We are worried.
Well, you're joined by your friend Mogis Kabedi. Mogis, can you tell me who you are, where you're from in Ethiopia, and you've heard from home?
Hey, from Addis, but my parents are from the northern part of Ethiopia. And like you said, Chris, the Ethiopian federal government waged war on November 4 to attack against the Tigrayan people, northern part. And right now, everything is roads, internet, phone lines, electricity, and water has been shut off. So there is no communication at all. So we don't know what is going on. I do have some family over there. I don't know what's happening at all. I know a lot of 25,000 people are fleeing the country to a neighboring Sudan country. I know they do require humanitarian aid. So really, there is nothing of knowing what is happening because everything is shut off.
Well, now, Salam, the government is saying that the forces, the Tigray forces led by the
TPLF. Tigray,
that, yes, thank you, the TPLF, they started this by attacking a military base. They deny that. There's accusations on both sides. How much do you know about what happened here, how this began?
I think the war did not happen because, as the government Ethiopia claimed, of the TPLF attacking the military, the federal military. I think the war and the rumors of war was happening since Abiy Ahmed went into power. Abiy Ahmed was part of the EPRDF, and TPLF was the leading party of the EPRDF. And once they voted him into power to replace Haile Mariam for 2 years, he turned against the TPLF, and he tried to change many of their coalition. He dismantled the coalition that EPRDF had. And once he dismantled, he basically fired everybody that was in the senior political leaders. Some of them were killed, but there was a disagreement. They weren't seeing eye to eye, and the TPLF retreated to Tigray. They just left the country. They don't want to be part of the new prosperity party that Abiy Ahmed came up with. They didn't agree with that, and they retreated to the TPLF, to the Tigray region. So there was rumors of rumors of war, and there was a lot of hate, a lot of between the two parties. And once they retreated to Tigray, they were only waiting to start that war from both sides.
And yeah. The TPLF, the People's Liberation Front, they've ruled over years through a coalition that has been broken by the current Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed. So, Mogis, now, can you tell us a little bit? Now, we know here that Abiy Ahmed is famous for the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize for brokering a peace between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Since he's come into power, he's never been elected. Is that right?
No, you know, like I say, the cause for this war, I think the main cause is there was a national election has been postponed indefinitely with the pretext of COVID-19. But the Tigray region decided to withhold, you know, with caution of, COVID-19. And they did the election. That is when the prime minister, he said he's going to punish. He said it to the public. You're going to pay the price for holding this election. This, he said that about 3 months ago. So that is how it started. Now, so the Tigray people now, this Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was planning to attack the northern region in alliance with the Eritrean government. So then the people now are, it's a matter of survival now. They have to withhold the northern military that is in Tigray. Not in a war type of thing, they just peacefully. And they agreed that the people on the federal force in northern region, they want to make alliance with the people of Tigray, TPLF, because they've been with them for 25 years in there. So they know the people. So it is not like what the government said. They killed the federal forces and that's how the war started. That is not true. But that is what the government is saying. Really, the actual thing is they want to attack the Tigray people. Tigray people, it's like I say, it's a matter of life and death. And then they, they make coalition with the northern federal force that has been in the Tigray region. And so that is the war started by the federal government.
See, well, and the prime minister too says that he wants to change the constitution, which in the Ethiopian constitution it allows for regional self-rule, as the in the north in Tigray, right?
Exactly, but he's been working against the every state can lead their own. That's what it says in the constitution, but he's not following that. But he kept saying the TPLF has broke the constitution. But if you read the Ethiopian constitution, they haven't broken any rules. They've been following the rules.
I mean, constitutions can be amended, not a problem, but not with a war. You see, that is a big problem, is he broke a war to attack one region.
This could have been solved in dialogue. This could have been, he's a Nobel Peace winner, medal winner, and he could have solved it. He could have fought for that peace, even if the TPLF wanted to have a war. He could have tried his best. He said he's tried his best, but personally, that wasn't good enough. That's not good enough.
Well, from an outsider's point of view, and I know very little about Ethiopia, I've been cramming on it today. Abiy Ahmed, there's some troubling aspects to his personality, it seems to me. You mentioned, Salam, that he had turned his back on the EPRDF, the people that had essentially brought him into power without an election. He was appointed leader. He turned his back on them and dissolved the party, forming a new party, the Prosperity Party. And he also turned his back and turned on the Oromo Youth Organization that had also brought him to power. There seems to be a pattern here of deception. Am I being overly critical or cynical here?
Not at all. Not at all. That's what happened. He turned his back against the people who brought it. Who brought him to where he is right now. He made the peace with Eritrea, but the Eritrean government, I was born and grew up in Eritrea. I was born in Eritrea. The Eritrean government has one newspaper in his country. He has one TV station in his country. He has no media in the country. People are exiling the country, creating a peace for 27 years. The Ethiopian people, ethnically, yes, there was an ethnic unrest. We know there was an ethnic unrest, but they were independent. They have a voice. Every ethnic group had a voice. In Eritrea, people don't have a voice. And I think Abiy Ahmed is following what the Eritrean government has been doing. He wants to silence. He wants to bring us back to where we were 27 years ago.
Well, and that's not an idle charge. The Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, he's very proud of his relationship with the President of Eritrea, Isaias. Is it a case of a young man following an older man's lead and being led down the path to autocracy?
I believe so. The Eritrean government has been, the Tigray people wanted the peace. The Tigray people has been dreaming the peace with Eritrea. They speak the same language. They've been dreaming for that. And when the peace happened, people were so happy. But the government, Isaias, wasn't happy because he doesn't like the Tigray people. He knows the Tigray people will not tolerate a dictator. They would not tolerate a dictator. Because that's why the TPLF was formed 40 years ago. Because the Tigray people has been bombed by the government that used to be the military regime that used to be 30, that fell before 28 years ago. Now, this bombing, this airstrike is reminding them of that time.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Salam Gebremeskel and Mogis Kabedi. Please forgive my horrible pronunciation here. This is all very new to me. Mogis, I was just hearing Salam saying she's from Eritrea. The Eritrean president, Isaias, is an autocrat. He didn't like the Tigray people of Ethiopia because they wouldn't put up with that kind of autocracy. Now the Tigray are have been rocketing the capital of Eritrea. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, I see, because the fight, if we call it a war, is between the federal government and the Tigray. But who started was the Eritrean start getting interfered. They start attacking the Tigray, the northern part of forces, through Afar region, through the southern part of Tigray, that they started launching heavy weapons.
We haven't heard, the Eritrean government hasn't confirmed or denied that, but the assumption is that they deny any involvement. Is there proof of Eritrean involvement?
The prisoners of war, there are prisoners, they're captured from Eritrea. They've been interviewed on the news. They've been saying a lot of things about, you know, they're not supporting the war. Isaias told them to go, and they're showing that.
Who is showing that? The way I understand it, the media has been clamped down by the government in Ethiopia, that they've shut down communications. Where are these pictures coming from?
Oh, from Tigray region. They captured more than 10,000 people. Then most of them are from Eritrea. They're Eritreans. Like Salam said, they speak the same language. They know. They know.
There was prisoners of war in Sudan that are speaking the Eritrean military speaking.
I was a little confused that the media coverage was, from what I've read, that it's been shut down. The internet's been shut down, though there is some access to Twitter. And in Ethiopia has also imprisoned Jawar Mohammed, who is the Oromo Media Network. He's been in jail. The opposition leader, Ledetu Ayello, is also in jail. The more I read about this government, the more worrying it seems to be.
I think Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize not only by making the peace with Eritrea. He also invited everybody that was working against the government in exile. Jawar was in the United States fighting for his people, for his Oromo people. And he invited him in. He invited many fighters that were outside Ethiopia. The minute they walked in, he threw them in jail. He threw all of them in jail. So to me, the democracy, the peace he spoke about is not happening. And my fear is the way he's siding with the Amhara people, creating this hate against the Tigrayan people and the Tigrayan people against the Amhara people against the Oromo people against the Amhara people. And he's feeding that, and he's backed by the Amhara people right now because they do have long buried hate against the TPLF. They do. They've been carrying that hate, and now freely coming out and slaughtering people.
Well, now the Prime Minister, and this is the Nobel winning Peace Prize Prime Minister of Ethiopia, he has said that the deadline for surrender that he had offered up is over. It's expired, and that there's no peace to be had. He's promising a big military push to finish once and for all this issue of Tigray and its restive attitude. What are the prospects of a military decisive battle coming soon if the Prime Minister is intent on making war instead of talking and granting amnesty?
Well, you see, basically what he's saying is the 3 days is over. I'm going to bombard. He's going to continue airstrike now, like aggressively, then maybe wipe the people. That's probably what he's going to do. That is the only option. With Isaias, allied with Isaias, I think that is what he meant by the deadline is over. That means I'm going to just bombard. It looks like. And he refused to give access to humanitarian aid. because there are more than a million people who need assistance. He said, no, I have to finish the war first. You know what he also said? They asked him, why don't you make a peace? He said, if I make a peace, my party and will be disappointed. That is what he said. They will be disappointed if I don't finish this war.
Already the UN is saying that there have been hundreds, they don't know for sure, hundreds of people killed. More than 25,000 people have been driven driven into exile, mostly into the Sudan, or maybe all. And Mekelle, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, or Mekelle?
Mekelle, yeah.
Mekelle, the Tigrayan capital, has come under aerial attack, and civilians there are being bombed. The UN also warns, although they seem supportive of the government, they have warned that war crimes could be committed right now.
I think I'm going to speak about, you asked Mogas about the Eritrean bombardment. I think the TPLF is asking for help. I think that's their way of stop the war. The TPLF leader has asked for the African Union to come in between the United Nations to look at the case. They were ready to sit down and talk. And if Abiy is a Nobel Prize medal winner, peaceful guy, peaceful leader, why wouldn't he take that opportunity? Why wouldn't he take that opportunity to stop the war? There is 6 million people, Tigrayan people in Tigray. These people served war after war after war. All the Ethiopian war was in Tigray, including when Ethiopia fought against Italians was in Tigray. Derg, the military regime, war was in Tigray. The Eritrean Ethiopian border war was in Tigray. And this war was in Tigray. These people, these 6 million people, have suffered years and years and years of war. Why wouldn't he care if these people are his people? Why wouldn't he care? Why wouldn't he get that opportunity when TPLF are saying, we need to talk, stop the war, let's stop the war? Why wouldn't he take that opportunity?
Well, the African Union has called for a ceasefire. And as I said, the United Nations is looking at the situation there. Up to now, all I've seen so far is that they're warning of possible war crimes. And they're worried because, as you mentioned before, Mogas, that aid is being used as a weapon by the government and being denied to the people. What third parties could get involved, sparing the African Union or the United Nations? Are there third countries that are friendly enough with both sides that could act as an intermediary?
Well, so far, nothing, really. United Nations, probably, and the African Union. Probably those are who can make this happen. Also, I just want to mention also one thing about, Abiy Ahmed, he won a Nobel Peace because he made a peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea, especially the northern part, the border of Tigray and Eritrea. But in 2 weeks, everything is closed. And he brought all the opposition party into the country. That was what made him a good leader. Everyone is now in jail. Everyone like Jawar Mohammed, Ledetu Ayale, all the opposition party brought from another, from U.S. and wherever, outside the country now, they're all in jail. So it's not a leader who you can trust. I think he tricked the international community, really. That is how I see him. And right now there is arrest in the city of Addis, all the Tigrayan people. And also media has been deployed now, dehumanizing labels against the Tigrayan people. Now what is afraid is a genocide might come because the media is now dehumanizing the Tigrayans. They started the war and really it's, they're doing a good work. And genocide is now, I think, one step
Alex Duval of the World Peace Foundation has a piece in the BBC, and he says in that article that there's more than 10,000 political prisoners in Ethiopia right now, put in prison by the prime minister, who is the Nobel laureate, although the Nobel Peace Prize has gone to other people that aren't exactly deserving of it. Mike Pompeo, the United States foreign minister, he says that, quote, "We strongly condemn the attack by the Tigray People's Liberation Front against Eritrea and the attempt to internationalize the conflict." I guess towards what you're saying is that by making this an international conflict, there is hope by the TPLF that it will bring in the UN and others to act as an intermediary to stop the war.
I would say this is a war against the Tigray people, because once you shut off electric, water, everything, how can be with the TPLF? It could be, it should be with the people of, in my opinion, this is a war against the Tigray people.
We're fast out of time here. Can you please summarize, can you tell our listeners how they can find out more information about Ethiopia and the situation, how they might be able to help if they have a mind to as well?
Yes, my heart goes for the people of Tigray. They're already in poverty. I have three sisters, cousins, aunts, and uncles. The only way they survive is through farming. And the locust infestation wiped out their crops. They have no food. There is war coming at them. I think the main the information you can get is, I would say, Al Jazeera is bringing, some good news, and that you can find some information. We are trying to set a GoFundMe to support the refugees in Sudan, and we're preparing for the aftermath to find our families if they survive or dead, and people to help us to look to support the Tigrayan people before famine wipes them out. Before diseases wipes them out, their own people is turning against them. Their own people are, the Ethiopian people are turning against them. So these people, this is humanitarian reason. This is not even political. This is humanitarian.
And again, Alex Duval has a very good piece at the BBC, Tigray Crisis Viewpoint, Why Ethiopia is Spiraling Out of Control. Did you have something you wanted to add, Mogis?
Yes, Chris. First of all, I thank you so much for amplifying our concerns through your media. So what I'm saying, this is a genocide happening right in front of our eyes. So we want whole nation, international world to involve and stop it before it's too late, because people are dying, children are dying, people have no access to food and to health care. So we are concerned so much, so do the international community. I urge international community to take action before it is too late.
This is our problem. This is the whole world's problem. We can't watch people get bombarded. We can't watch that. Stop the war and work with the government senior TPLF people. Do not touch the people or the people. There's 6 million people in Tigray.
And Salam, has the Canadian government made a statement yet?
No, not at all.
No, today there are, in Ottawa, there is a huge peaceful rally in Ottawa as we speak. So I'm hoping there will be a statement made by the Canadian government. The international community as well.
Well, Salam, we Gebremeskel and Mogis Kabedi, please forgive my horrible pronunciation again. Thanks a lot for coming on and telling us about the situation in your home country. And I urge that you have courage and that our listeners keep an eye tuned for this. Thanks again for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for voicing our concern. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Allaya nallayuma maltu wallaya anuru fajdei alagana laguma maltu wallaga adam firajdei
Oporta ormina ma batu yo abano fi batate malei roro orma radufte roro dina radufte maltuna malo o abado watamale malo 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 biya orma adakuna man ibu galuna man ibai biya ofi ya gadisa garbu aduna man argu jarani.